Welcome back to Gulf Coast Live. I'm Mike Canary. An exoplanet is a planet that's orbiting a star other than our sun. While it might seem obvious that at least some stars outside of our solar system would have planets orbiting around them, scientific evidence proving their existence was not discovered until the late 1980s. Since that first discovery, though, scientists have discovered more than 3,700 exoplanets and almost 2,800 systems. I'm joined for the rest of the hour by Dr. Dawn Gelino. She's Deputy Director of the Exoplanet Science Institute at the California Institute of Technology in Pasadena. She's on campus today for a Whitaker Center seminar called Working Together Works Better, NASA's Nexus Initiative to Search for Life in the Universe. It's this afternoon at 3:30 in Reed Hall. Dr. Gelino, welcome to Gulf Coast Live. Thanks for your time today.
Thank you very much.
If you'd like to join our conversation about the search for exoplanets, the number to call is 877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. On Facebook, we're at WGCU Public Media. And on Twitter, we're at WGCU using the hashtag GCL. So how is the search for life in the universe going these days?
The search for life in the universe is really exciting. We are finding more planets every day. At this point, we think there's probably at least one planet around every star in the sky. And we're moving from finding the planets to trying to characterize them to see if they can harbor life.
What is the nexus for exoplanet system science? Can you just kind of give us a brief description of sort of the what you're doing there?
Sure. So Nexus is a NASA initiative that brings together scientists from all different disciplines. So we have heliophysicists that study the sun. We have planetary scientists that look at the planets in our own solar system. We have astrophysicists that look at extrasolar planets, exoplanets. And we have Earth scientists that look at the Earth, geologists. And they're all looking – all of these roughly 250 scientists are looking at figuring out planetary habitability. So, you know, when we look out at an exoplanet, you know, how can we tell whether that planet might be habitable or not? And so we're looking at this one question with from lots of different points of view.
Where are what are all the different universities and research institutes or agencies that are behind this? Like, it's not all just there at Caltech.
No, it's not. In fact, I'm pretty much the only member that's at Caltech. Well, I'm one of the co-leads. There are three co-leads. We're located I'm at Caltech / JPL, the Jet Propulsion Laboratory. We have another co-lead up at NASA Ames, and then a third at NASA Goddard. And we have, you know, we have oversight from NASA headquarters, of course. But the member, the scientists are from all over the country, and we even have some from Europe. So all different universities. We have Yale, University of Maryland, University of Arizona, UC Berkeley, just a whole array. Penn State. There's a whole array of universities that are part of this.
So how did you, you know, what's the relatively short version of how did you wind up as a, you know, NASA scientist, basically, right?
Right. So I never thought I'd be here. I mean, ever since I was a little girl, I wanted to work for NASA. That was kind of a dream of mine. Had great physics teacher in high school, a great astronomy teacher as an undergrad, and that put me on the path for astronomy. I got my PhD in 2001 and started a postdoc fellowship at UC San Diego and, you know, just doing pure research. It was actually on black holes, not on exoplanets at all. And I started looking for, you know, other jobs as my postdoc was finishing, and I ended up getting recruited before my postdoc was finished up at Caltech to work for what was then called the Michelson Science Center. And we're now the NASA Exoplanet Science Institute. I've worked my way up the food chain, and I'm the deputy director now. But we run a lot of programs for NASA headquarters. And so it's kind of by chance that I got to be in this position. Not purely by chance. It was a lot of hard work.
Yeah. Sounds like it.
Yeah. So
what happened in 1998, I believe, was the year. So what was the step forward that allowed us to finally say we know that there are planets around that star?
So the Hubble Space Telescope actually noticed that the brightness of a specific star was fading every now and then. And so we figured out that that was due to a planet that was passing in front of that star. And so this is a method called the transit method that has been used to find most of the majority of the planets that we have – that we know of today. And so we just see this dip in the brightness, and then all of the theorists get to work and say, what would cause this? And, you know, it was a repeatable dip in the brightness.
Right, right.
And
so it was the Hubble Space Telescope.
Hubble Space Telescope. Yeah. So there were a few ground-based telescopes that looked at it before, but it's a lot easier to get cleaner data, less noisy data
from
space.
How big a deal was it? I mean, is it probably a really big deal, I would think? I mean, these are people who've been, you know, that they're standing on the shoulders of people who've been looking up for thousands of years. So mm-hmm. How big a deal was it? And do you recall being aware of it happening? You said you grew up being into NASA, but were you into mm-hmm. NASA enough to say, Mom, Dad, they found an exoplanet? You know what mm-hmm. I mean?
So I think I was vaguely aware of it. I wasn't really looking. I was working more on black holes at the time. It was a really big deal, though, because – you know, as you said, you know, people had been looking for these for a long time, and you know, other people in the community would tell them, "Oh no, you're nuts! Like, you're never going to find these things."
Well, that
things.
Was my other
They're
question:
real
is, too. Is yeah. there were naysayers?
Oh yeah, absolutely, there were naysayers. So yeah, it's not until we found a few of them that people were like, oh, maybe this is really a thing.
So were the naysayers – did they claim or did they – I don't know if you can say and answer this mm-hmm. accurately, but did they think that we just would never be able to find evidence or – because it doesn't seem at all logical to think that we could live in a – infinite universe and there's no other planets. I mean, that seems
right.
hard to believe.
So the evidence was the hard part, right? So these – It's really hard to get a picture of a planet, and in fact, we don't have many
right.
pictures of planets.
Right.
We have one system that there are some very very large planets that happen to be, you know, pretty bright, and over, you know, a 7-year time span, we've actually seen a little bit of motion of these four planets around their star. But you know, looking for these planets is like looking for a lightning bug next to. Next to a lighthouse
right.
that's on, so it, from very very far away, so it's next to impossible. You have to block out the light from the star in order to see the planet, and that's very difficult to do.
Was that the first big thing that NASA brought back? I mean, that Hubble brought back, because I know, you know, Hubble really was a paradigm shift in terms of studying the stars.
It was yeah. Hubble did, but Hubble has done lots of groundbreaking science, and so. I don't believe that the exoplanet discovery was – it wasn't the first, that's
gotcha.
For sure. But it's one of many that that Hubble has helped with.
My guest is Dr. Dawn Gelino, Deputy Director of the Exoplanet Science Institute at Caltech. She's in town to present a seminar later today at FGCU. If you'd like to ask a question or make a comment, give us a call now. The number is 877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. So how much – of the research is being done from land-based telescopes versus space-based telescopes?
That's a good question. A lot of the discoveries are being done by space-based telescopes.
And so is our current best space telescope? Is there something supplanted Hubble by now, right?
The Kepler Space Telescope, that mission ran for 4 years. It lost two of its four reaction wheels, but the engineers at Ball actually figured out how to make it still point in the right direction and be pretty stable using the solar pressure from the sun, which is amazing. And
space engineers,
yeah, they were great. So the mission came back as what we call K2. That mission is actually almost out of fuel. So in the next few months, it will run out of fuel and it will stop. It will stop taking data because it won't be able to point and keep on the same star. But so that's where most of our exoplanet discoveries have come from. Next month, there's TESS that's launching,
mm-hmm.
and that will kind of – it's more of a survey telescope, whereas the initial Kepler just pointed at one point in the sky and looked at 150,000 stars continuously basically for 4 years. K2 looks at different fields for roughly 3-month time periods. TESS is going to scan the sky. And it will look at significantly brighter stars. So those stars will be easier to follow up potential planets from the ground. But I think space is really – it's kind of where we – going forward, we need to use space.
So who gets to decide where to point these things? Because it seems like, you know, there's got to be – that's, I'm sure, a big part of your job is coordinating that. So talk about that, because if there's just that one thing and there's all these researchers, then how does that – how is time divvied up?
So it varies by mission. It's a competitive process in basically all cases. Sometimes NASA says this is where you're going to point, or sometimes when the people that are in charge of the mission, when they come up with the mission, they say this is what we're going to do. And so sometimes it's already predetermined where it will point. That was the case for the Kepler mission. And for TESS, it's going to scan the sky. So
right,
that's different. But for instance, for K2, there are different fields. You can't always get all of the data down because it takes a long time, and there are other reasons. So they have to pick certain areas of the pixels of the camera to bring the data down, and so that's a competitive process. And so every cycle, which varies, usually it's a year-ish or somewhere between 6 months and a year, there's a competitive process, and it's all peer-reviewed.
So people are like basically making proposals.
Right.
And
they
then
write
being decided upon.
Right. Gotcha. Yeah. By their peers.
Hmm. Where does, if at all, SETI, the institute, fit into what you guys are doing? Or are they completely like on their own little planet?
I wouldn't say they're on their own little planet. I wouldn't say they're on their own little planet. We definitely have some SETI scientists or people that are affiliated with SETI working as part of Nexus. But what they are doing, listening for radio signals and whatnot, is separate from what we're trying to do with Nexus. It's a supplemental. I mean, they kind of work together.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
So the blurb for today's seminar says, the goals of Nexus is to investigate the diversity of exoplanets and to learn how their history, geology, and climate interact to create the conditions for life. So just how much of those things can we learn from a telescope?
Well, we're hoping we can learn a lot of those things, many of those things.
But that's still ongoing science?
It is ongoing science. I mean, this is why Nexus was put together, because planets are hard. Planets are really, really hard. You need to know – if we're looking for liquid water, you need to know about the planet. You need to know about the star that it's orbiting, and you need to know about what else is going on in that planetary system. And so – and it's not just that. You need to know different aspects of the star, which wavelengths does it really give its light at? And for the planet, does it have an atmosphere? Is it rocky or is it gaseous?
And how do you determine if it's got an atmosphere? I mean, is that just all in the wavelengths that you're interpreting? I mean, is it
– more or less.
simplification.
No, it is. But it's a really complicated process. But so in terms of – the Kepler mission, right? So it was measuring brightnesses over time, and so you saw the brightness of the star dip as the planet passes in front, and you can look at how long that transit takes, how long the dip is, and that tells you how fast the planet is traveling in front of the star. You can look at how deep the dip is, how much of the light is blocked by the planet, and that tells you how big the planet is. You can look at the shape of the transit, and that's the shape of it helps to tell you whether there's an atmosphere or not. But it can give you a clue anyway. It's not decisive. And then if the object is bright enough, you can try to take what's called a spectrum, basically a measurement of the light versus wavelength. So how bright that object is per wavelength. And we know, from chemistry, the fingerprint of each of the elements in the periodic diagram. And so we look for things like hydrogen and stuff like that. So, I mean, we're still working to get enough resolution in the data.
This is still relatively new.
It is.
It's only 30 years old since we – yeah. So
right.
How much will the new – what's the new telescope being called, the one that scans?
Tess.
Mm-hmm. How much will that advance the ability to refine? You know, will it make it one order of something better in terms of being able to collect that kind of data?
Well, it will be looking at brighter stars. So those brighter stars will be easier to follow up. So a lot of the information about the planets we actually get from looking at the star.
Gotcha.
And the interaction. It's more the interaction of the planet with the star. And so it will be I don't think I can fairly give any order of estimate.
That's okay. But,
yeah.
But it will be – I mean obviously it's going to be somehow better, although I
– It will be, and it's looking at a lot of stars over the whole sky. So Kepler, we found almost – well, you said before, right, 3,700 confirmed planets,
yeah,
and we have about 4,500 more candidates that we're still trying
those
to
confirm. Those are the
Kepler
candidates?
Those are the Kepler candidates,
yes. I was going to ask that. That's what I thought that meant.
And that – that's purely from looking at discrete – small portions of the sky. TESS is going to scan the entire sky, northern and southern hemisphere. And so we're going to have just oodles of data. We're
gotcha. So that number might go up real fast.
It probably will.
Gotcha. Yeah. How many – I don't know if you know the exact answer to this or can get close. How many Earth-like, quote-unquote, planets have we discovered? Are you guys, not we?
Well, I haven't discovered any of them. But the community, the astronomical community I don't know that number off the top of my head. I probably should. But it's – I want to say on the order of 100 or
– Any idea how close –
It's probably less than that actually.
Any idea how close the closest one is? I mean, are we still talking hundreds or thousands of light years away?
So actually one of the – there's a system called TRAPPIST-1 that was discovered a little over a year ago, and it has seven – Earth-sized planets in it, mm-hmm. and that one's only 40 light years away. So that's – I think that's the closest – it's pretty close to us.
That's pretty close.
Pretty close.
In terms of, the big universe,
right.
40 light years is pretty close.
Yes, yeah.
And how do we – I guess you already kind of answered how we know they're Earth-like. It's still part of – it's cobbling together all those different ways you can determine what a planet – has or is.
Right. So you look at the transits. So you look at the depth of the transit and the duration of the transit and the timing of the transit too in this case. So we know that there are seven planets because they all gravitationally interact, mm-hmm. right? So they have an effect on each other. And so you would think if it's just one planet going around a star, you would see the same transit at a regular periods, right, at regular intervals. But because there are so many planets and this system happens – it's tiny, so they're really packed in there. And so they actually perturb the system a little bit where sometimes the planet will pass in front of the star a little sooner than you expect – if there's nothing else in the system, and sometimes a little bit later. Hmm. And so you have to take into account all the gravitational interactions too.
We only have a couple minutes left, but your seminar's title starts with the phrase, working together works better. Can you talk about the importance of collaboration and the challenges of collaboration?
Right. So I mentioned before that planets are hard, right? We have to look at all of these these systems or basically – if we want to look for planetary habitability, if we want to investigate it, we need to know lots of different things about the planets and the stars. And even if you're the smartest person on the face of the earth, you would never have time to investigate all of the different nuances. And so you really have to get people who can work on different parts of the same problem working together. And because all of these all of these things are dependent on each other. So, whether the planet has an atmosphere, will definitely make a difference if you can have life on that planet. But it also – is it the right type of atmosphere for that type of star? So you need to figure out what type of star it is and then how it interacts with the planet, with the atmosphere if there is one. And so there's a lot of interdependency. So you really need people with different expertise to come together and try to answer the same question.
Is it hard to get people who are working at that level to work together sometimes?
They all speak different languages,
right.
It's different scientific languages. And so like the geologists don't know what a K-star is and instance.
Right.
So yeah, and so it's difficult at first, but we've run this program for about 2.5 years now, and I think everybody understands now when they say a word, everybody has the same definition for that word in their head, whereas at the beginning it was different.
Gotcha.
And so we've worked hard to make sure that they all were on the same page. And they're working together really well. They're excited to get other people's perspectives on the same program. So –
Is there a – and the last question, is there, mm-hmm. is there a next sort of hopeful milestone for your work? Is the launch of the new telescope it, or is there something else that would be like, we think we can answer this question and maybe it'll happen any day?
I'm not sure it would happen any day, but there's the James Webb Space Telescope is the next big thing that's going to be launched.
That's the one I knew about. I didn't know about TESS.
TESS is a smaller mission that will really have a big effect on the exoplanet field. But JWST is kind of the successor to Hubble.
Yeah.
And we're really hoping that can give us information, more information about water on planets and methane and, you know, things that biomarkers that we're looking for to see if we can potentially have life. And that won't launch until at least December 2019.
Gotcha. Well, that is all the time we have for today's show. I want to thank my guest, Dr. Don Gelino, is Deputy Director of the Exoplanet Science Institute at the California Institute of Technology in Pasadena. She's on campus today for a Whitaker Center seminar called Working Together Works Better, NASA's Nexus Initiative to Search for Life in the Universe. It's this afternoon at 3:30 in Reed Hall. Dr. Gelino, thanks for coming in. I enjoyed our conversation.
Thank you very much.
And thanks to our earlier guest, Dr. Abby Finn, Director of the Clinical Mental Health Counseling Program at FGCU. Our show today was produced by Julie Glenn and myself. Our director is Richard Chin Kui. Our social media coordinator is Tara Callaghan. Gulf Coast Live is made possible through the generous support of the Elizabeth B. McGraw Foundation. For now, thanks for listening. I'm Mike Canary. This is WGCU FM Fort Myers 90.1, WMKO Marco Island 91.7 FM, NPR for Southwest Florida.